Doug Gottlieb here, and thanks so much for downloading this All Ball podcast. You are going to love this one. Love it. Today's guest is the head coach of Liberty University. And, man, I've known Richie for a long time. I remember Richie for a long time. I didn't realize that he recruited me to, or tried to recruit me to go to Washington. And I didn't go. He actually, Richie McKay, ended up landing Jason Terry that year. But for people that remember, Jason Terry flipped at the last second, went to Arizona. And then a couple years later, they end up getting Dan Dickow. That was after he was gone. But Richie McKay is the head coach of Liberty. The Flames are getting ready for the NCAA tournament. They're taking on Oklahoma State, my alma mater, and Cade Cunningham. He's had a mercurial crazy journey where started off in Indy, made his way to the Pacific Northwest playing college basketball, played overseas, came back to Seattle, bounced around back to Seattle with UW, went to Portland State, Portland State, Colorado State, Oregon State, and then ultimately New Mexico, got fired in New Mexico. We got a lot to get to. So I think what I'm going to do is record a special pod with some picks and maybe drop that tomorrow. What do you guys say, before the tournament starts? I know the first four starts then. Record some picks. But I thought you'd really enjoy this conversation with a guy who has, you know, by his own accounts, he's gone through some ups and downs in this business. But the ups, Liberty would have gone last year likely to the tournament. And they did go 2 years ago, and they did pull an upset. And now they got Oklahoma State that they're staring down the barrel of. And we'll see if they can pull off that upset as a 13 seed taking on a 4. The head coach of the Liberty Flames is Richard McKay. He joins me now.
Taking back your first memories of hoop, or when and where?
Man, I think I was, 5 or 6 and had a Nerf hoop, and I was balling on the Nerf hoop, Doug, like deep range, reverse dunks, all the above.
And did you have my dad and mom, they had their door to their bedroom. There's like a closet next to it on the right hand side. So I had the ability to shoot the ball off the side and then off the like wall. And like I had all the trick shots as well. And then my brother and I, we would play like these vicious games of one-on-one full court dunk hoop. Cause they had like a little kind of alleyway in their bedroom. And so what was the Nerf hoop setup?
All of that. I had an older brother. We get in fights every day, and we had the JV version of the Nerf hoop, though. You know, the net was all jacked up, and it was my dad played at the University of New Mexico, and he's from Indianapolis, Snaptown. It's where Hoosier Hysteria lives. So basketball was just prevalent in our home. It was always talked about, and that's where I got my passion for it.
How good a player were you?
Not as good as you, but, I love the game, and I ate, slept, and breathed it. So I was highly competitive and ended up playing at Seattle Pacific and then overseas for a couple of years. I really got the most out of my ability just because of how many hours I spent in it or on it, but never really thought I'd coach, but loved to play.
Okay. So Seattle Pacific, who's your coach?
Guy named Claude Terry. You remember Coach Terry, don't you?
Sure. Claude,
he was the all-time, at the time, he was the all-time leading scorer at Stanford. I think Todd Lichty passed him and some others since then. But played the NBA or ABA in the NBA. He was tremendous for me, not just because of his basketball acumen, but he was also a tremendous mentor. I used to go up to his office acting like I wanted to talk some ball. And honestly, Doug, I really just wanted to spend time with him. He's fabulous.
How'd you guys play?
Played a little up-tempo, a little pro style.
And then in terms of he was just a great mentor, and you want to hang out around him, what sorts of things, like, again, you're a college kid, he's an adult, you know, he's lived a life. So, like, how would he mentor you? Because those are the building blocks of who you are as a person, who you are as a coach. Like, we have people, and frankly, it's in my profession, not yours, but especially my profession, who they minimize the importance of that relationship between college coach and player, and how much, you know, so many kids now come from split families. Some comes from dysfunctional families, but even ones that come from, like, I had a two-parent household, but my college coaches were father type figures. What was he like during those times spent with you when you pretended like you wanted to talk ball?
Yeah, the word that comes to mind is he was transformational. You know, not only did he have these great stories, and he would help me visualize the dreams that I had when he talked about the work ethic you needed to be a pro, or the commitment that you had to have. But what was most important or most valuable to me, man, he loved me unconditionally. You know, with all of my junk or all of the voids or holes, wounds that I had in my life, I just felt like he was there. And he was the first man that I'd ever met who actually read the Bible that he had on his desk. And just tremendously considerate of who I was as a person, and it made me feel valuable, and had these words of life that he would relate to scripture that I just thought was instrumental to my development. And I didn't know it then, but I found out later what he was doing is he was just preparing me for what was going to be a career choice that I was going to make, and how the importance of a person's play or results of their statistics, that wasn't as important as a person's heart and a person's well-being. And I just think from some of those fundamentally deposited principles, it helped shape me in however many years, 30 years ago, into who I am today.
So you get done playing. How good was your team?
We were decent. We didn't make it to the NCAA tournament, but we were decent.
So you get done playing. And then what was the decision like to go play overseas?
I was first working. I was from Seattle, or lived in Seattle. I was working for Basketball Travelers, Nels Hawkinson. And I finally got the call to go play in New Zealand. And so I did that. I had a friend of mine who I worked with as a graduate assistant at University of Washington the first time I was there. He got me in touch with a guy named Dale Lair. And between seasons in New Zealand, I went to go be a Division II assistant at Queens College. Never really thought coaching was going to be my deal. I wanted to hoop, man. I wanted right. to play as long as I could. So, but one thing led to that.
Yeah. Go ahead. So, wait. So Queens College, who's the head coach?
Dale Lair.
Okay. And that's in Queens, New York?
It's in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was
the Queen City. Okay, got it.
It was an all-girls school, and they hired Coach Lair to bring back basketball to the campus. So the first 13 men on campus were basketball players.
All basketball players.
Yeah,
and that's actually kind of an. I mean, like, I know it's a religious school, but it's kind of an easy sale there. Like, hey man, you want to come and play basketball at an all-girls school? Like, you're literally the only guy.
Yeah. The ratio, the female to male ratio was like 9-1. I mean, dudes, if you can't get a date there, you're going to have a rough go of it.
It's a you problem, right? Yeah. You can't get a date at Queens College when there's 13 dudes on campus.
Yeah.
What was Dale like as a coach, and what was your job during your time you were there?
Yeah. You know, at the Division II ranks, you do a little bit of everything. Coach Lair was phenomenal. He had a balance that was really healthy between family life and how much time he spent with his career, with our players. And I lived across the street from the gym, so and was single at the time. So I had a ton of access, ton of freedom. Another one that God sent my way to model for me what a coach should look like. And I know you know this. Your dad was a coach, and you know, as a son who has a coach in his home, how much time he really invests in other kids' lives, you know? I just felt like Coach Lair was, he was committed in developing and transforming, but he was also really good in his own home. And again, another foundational piece for me that would set the table for how I tried to pursue my career when I was a parent.
Were you, I know religion is so important in your life, and obviously, you know, you're at a place like Liberty, but Were you raised in a very religious home, or is this something that took place during your kind of formative college years, where you where your views became much more Christian based?
Yeah, my mom and dad were divorced, so I grew up in a home that had a faith, and we went to church. My older brother really had a strong faith that kind of inspired me. And man, when I was 19, I was just finishing up high school, or 18, and I went to junior college my freshman year. That's when I invited Jesus into my life and have been a Christian ever since. So I think, you know, for me, Doug, I describe it as, you know, that night I made that decision, it was like opening the door to a mansion, and so many rooms to explore, so many experiences to have in this great big old house. And I'm still in the mansion, still experiencing them. But it gave me a sense of peace and purpose that I'd never had before.
So, okay, Queens College, you're playing professionally. What made you come back stateside to coach again?
Yeah, I came back and I got a job at Seattle Pacific. I married Julie, who has been my wife for 30 years, going on 31 in August. And I came back to my alma mater. And shortly after that, I got a chance to go to Bradley University with Jim Molinari, and then back to the Northwest when I started recruiting you.
Wait, hold on. You're like skipping all around here. So Coach Mo, people who know him in the Midwest, right? Now, did you know my dad signed him in college?
No. Did he really?
Yeah.
No way.
At Creighton.
Is that right?
I believe at Creighton. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're talking about Jim Molinari.
Jim Molinari. Go look.
I didn't know he had a game.
Yeah, no, he was a hell of a player. And then I think he transferred to Western Illinois, right? That was
I think you're right.
Yeah, so he went to Creighton. And, I mean, I never forget it. Like, I did a Bradley game one time. And I think my dad had mentioned it. I don't really remember how it came up. And then, you know, like, there's a little bit of Forrest Gump where where's Waldo, where all of a sudden, like, I'd be like, I was at Minnesota, and there's, like, Coach Mo on the staff. And then I was in Nebraska, and there's Coach Mo on the staff with Tim Miles. And you know, all those, he's got all these stories about my dad. So,
Coach Mo was, man, was he was so intense. The hiring process alone, you know, he took me, I'd never been Division I, and he took me and he really groomed me. He made me value how hard it was at that level. And he was relentless in his work ethic. But, man, he was a really, really good coach. And another one, again, another one of the people that was valuable in my life in building some foundation. But I was only there.
You're on there for how long?
2 years, yep.
So your wife really enjoyed the area? That's what you're telling me, in Peoria?
Well, Bob Bender.
Yeah, I'm in Seattle, which is an incredible city, right? And, yeah. Like, look, I know how important basketball is to Peoria, right? If it plays in Peoria, right, the old Vaudeville, they love hoops. But it's really hard to go from Seattle to Peoria. Let's just call it like it is.
No doubt. I like Peoria, don't get me wrong, but Seattle is not a home.
Okay, so then you got a job at UW?
Yeah, so Bob Bender left Illinois State to go to University of Washington. Obviously, the Redbirds and the Braves are
rivals,
big rivals. And mm-hmm. Bender, I think, had a little bit of a level of respect for the job that we were doing at Bradley. And I got to know Ray Giacoletti in that recruiting process. We'd be recruiting against each other. And Billy King was his initial hire, and Billy went to go to the NBA, and Coach Bender called me in the summer and asked if I wanted to come back to Seattle. And a day later I was on the plane and started the rebuild.
Right, like, you go, I'll pack. You go, I'll pack. That speaks to the respect. You hire a guy who you competed against in the league. And then, of course, location-wise, it totally made sense. I love that you were the second choice. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Right? That's that's happened to a lot of people. It just works out. Okay. So you get to UW. It's 1993, I believe.
Yep.
Right? 1993. Tech Ed's a cool place, but I don't remember UW being any good at that point in time.
Oh, we were.
Who preceded was Marv Harshman wasn't the coach before. Well, who was the coach before?
Coach before, gosh. After us, it was Lynn Nance. Who was the coach before? I can't even remember. It was it Les Stevens? Lynn Stevens?
Okay.
Yeah, yes. He was at
let's just go yes. So you're there. So now all of a sudden, okay, you have to go from the Valley, okay, which is really, remember, mid-90s at the time, like Tulsa is rolling.
Oh, no.
Absolutely rolling. You know, the whole league is kind of ridiculous at that point. That people forget how good the Valley was going back then.
Yeah. Charlie Spower had the Bears rolling. That then was Southwest Missouri. That was such good basketball and incredibly difficult home court venues to go in and try and get a dub. The Valley was legit.
Was totally legit.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Okay, so what was Bob Bender's plan for, was it just we got to recruit all these local kids? Or what did you guys set? How did you decide to rebuild that program?
You know, I think part of it was trying to keep guys in the Seattle area or Northwest area close to home. You know, at the time, Oregon wasn't Oregon like it is now, and OSU had struggled a little bit, and Washington State. Now, Kelvin was there, and he kind of had it rolling. So we felt like we had to at least try and be able to win our state, and he wanted to do it with West Coast kids. But Coach Bender, you know, was a former Duke assistant, so – kind of had contacts all over. We weren't afraid to go anywhere in the country to try and get someone, but we really knew we had to be good close to home. And again, that's when I saw this tough, hard-nosed point guard that, and I don't know if people give you enough credit, but you were one of the best passers that I'd ever seen in high school basketball. I mean, elite. You were elite. And, you know, but you big timed us, you know, you went to Notre Dame and.
I didn't big time you. Well, here's how I remember it. Okay. Didn't you have other guards? You had, older guards. So I would have had to sit for you. So again, this is where you have to factor in. Like part of our problem, I thought in recruiting to my dad and I, is we kind of knew too much. Right. Yeah. So you start, but also there was a level of lack of faith because Washington hadn't been good.
Yeah.
Just hadn't, you know, it was before Washington took off. It's hard to relate to people now. And I don't think people understood Tech Ed and how great a place that was to play back then.
Yeah.
Right. All of it hadn't hit yet. Yeah. But you did, you signed McCullough, right? And Dion, yeah, Luton and Donald Watts. And I believe before you left, you tell me if I'm wrong, you guys actually had a commitment from Jason Terry.
Man, great memory. Right?
Okay. Great. And then what happened? So what happened? Tell me the Jason Terry story, because this is the old midnight loot. What really happened? How did Jason Terry go from committed hometown Washington kid, turn this thing around to all of a sudden he's playing? He went to be a sixth man. He didn't start Arizona until his senior year.
I know. Man, what's funny about it, you know, I was only there 2 years as well. And then I got the job at Portland State as a head coach, but We were starting to flip it a little bit. We were becoming more competitive, and when Donald Watts committed, we had he and Jason Terry on campus for some elite camp or something. And I was close to JT. Like we would talk every day. I talked to moms, and he committed. So we thought we legit had one of the best backcourts in the country, certainly in the West, but maybe in the country. And Jason called one night and he said, "Hey, coach, man, coach, I didn't get anything to compare to, and I'm not going to go to Arizona, but I just got to take another visit. I'm not going there, coach. I promise you, I'm not going there." I said, "You want to take a visit?" He said, yeah, but I'm not going there. You know, me and my mom, we just want to see something else. You know, it's Arizona, coach." I said, "Jay, man, I'm just telling you, it's hard to say no to them. Coach Olson, You know, he's known for nabbing a dude at the midnight hour. And he said,
yeah, midnight loot.
Yeah, he said, Coach, you ain't got nothing to worry about. Didn't hear
from him. Famous last word.
Right. Didn't hear from him for about 3 days. And he called me and said, Coach, man, I made the switch. I said, man, I'm not telling Coach Bender. You got to tell him. And, he broke my heart. But he had a heck of a career there and in the league. But, man, that was Coach Olson, Matt Othick. There was a few of them now. Matt Othick, who was – didn't he commit to UNLV? And Coach Flip. Yep, there was a few of them. And with good reason. Arizona's a great program. But, man, that was a tough one.
Okay, so you get to Portland State. At the time, had they just gone Division One?
Portland State was a restart. They had in 79, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Freeman Williams were three of the names on the first team All-America list. Well, they banned the program after Freeman Williams left because of NCAA improprieties. Did not have basketball for 16 years, and they decided to restart it. And when they restarted, they were announced they were going to Division One, and we had an 8-year probationary period that we couldn't play in the NCAA tournament. So I got the job, Doug, because nobody else wanted it.
but it's your program, and you're how old this time?
I'm 29. I'm the youngest head coach in the country.
Okay, so you're 29. How much are you making?
I think the salary was $60,000 at the time.
Okay, beautiful area, right? You're a Pacific Northwest guy anyway.
Yep.
Like an incredible place to live.
Yeah.
So what's the process like of legitimately starting a program?
Yeah, you know, it was incredibly healthy for me. The first year we were there, we got 2 scholarships and didn't field a team. But we took Brian Towne, who was a walk-on at University of Washington that came with us. And I had one assistant, Brad Susie, who's been with me every day since then.
I know. He never leaves your side. I got it.
Yeah. And we took a kid.
How'd you meet Brad? Where'd Susie come from?
Brad was in, he was a food broker for Damon and Associates. I met him through a mutual friend. He was a heck of a player. At the time, he was at Eastern Michigan. He set an NCAA tournament record for most 3-pointers in a game. He made 9 of them. They lost to Pitt when Pitt had Demetrius Gore and Sean Miller. But Brad scored like 27 points in 21 minutes. I said, man, 27 points in 21 minutes? Why Coach Braun only play you 21 minutes if you had 27? He said, that's why I transferred.
Coach, points per minute, Coach. Pro-rate that, Coach.
Do the math, Coach. So, yeah, Seuss and I hit it off. You know, faith had us share the same faith, the passion for basketball, love to work with kids. So the first year we sit out. We played 2-on-2 nearly every day. You know, that's Damon Stoudemire's dad. His Willie played at Portland State. So Damon would run his summer camps at our gym. And, of course, Dame would be there for a day or two. And, man, we'd have some of the best runs in the city at Portland State's gym. That's where I met Ime Udoka and Cabino. All the guys would come to PSU and play. So we started and then we had to transfer Jason Hartman our second year. And ended up, yeah, we ended
Hartman
up.
Hartman was Wazoo?
Hartman was at UW.
He's at UW. So you recruited him at UW, and then when he transferred, you brought him with you.
Correct.
Yeah, so, he's a good player.
So that first year, you know, I when we didn't have practice, I would go and I visited Dick Davey at Santa Clara, Dick Bennett, who was at Wisconsin, and man, I just watched practice. I got to learn. I got to absorb. And then the first year of us actually playing, you know, the internet wasn't what it is now, and there's not social media. So I got to make all these mistakes that no one saw. But we had the right kind of kids. So we got fairly competitive in just 2 short years and went 15-12. But I'm telling you, it was really hard to recruit, Doug. Yeah, we can't go to the tournament for 6 more years. But the guys we had, man, I loved coaching them, and they were the guys that no one else wanted and had something to prove. So it ended up helping us be really competitive in a very early stage of our program.
How did New Mexico come to be?
So after Portland State, I took the job at Colorado State, and was there for two years.
Right. Okay, sorry, I skipped a step. Let me. Okay, so how'd the Colorado State happen?
Again, we that second year, you know, we took a restart program, and the AD at the time, Tim Weiser, called and said he had an interest, and I can't remember who the other candidate was. Oh yeah, it's the late Neil Doherty, who was at Kansas, and it was he and I ended up getting the job, and we inherited a program from Stu Morrill, who was a heck of a coach. You remember Coach Morrill, right?
Yeah, of course, of course. He went to Utah State.
Yep, yep, tremendous coach. And we inherited that program, and Coach Morrill would call play every time down. They used the card system, and we had a little different philosophy. But so I think the kids kind of felt good about, you know, maybe being able to play a little bit more freely offensively. But he had such a good culture. I think we won 19 the first year, went to the Elite Eight of the NIT, and then 18 the next year. And man, it was that's when my career, I was there for 2 years. So 2 years at Portland State, 2 years at Colorado State. And then I took the Oregon State job. And Mitch Barnhart was the athletic director. And I took it because, number one, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. And it was a chance to recruit LA, be in LA a ton, go back and forth, bigger budget. The Pac-10 at the time, it was, you know, is what I had always aspired for. In terms of level, and yeah, it was a tough job, man. And I didn't do a good job there, Doug. I wasn't. Well, your brother coached there. You know, it's, and Wayne Tinkle's done a fabulous job.
Well, it's a little different now, but I mean, like, look, they had Gill Coliseum is ancient. They've redone a bunch of it now, and they built a practice facility now.
Yeah.
Right. But it's, you know, I mean, it's nothing short of a miracle what Ralph Miller did forever, and what they're doing now. Like, people don't understand. You know, they're in Wazoo. I mean, those are hard, especially with all the money Oregon's spending and the location of UW. Okay, so if you could go back and think, okay, should you have not taken the Oregon State job? Was it the was there something you did that you would fix? Like, why? Don't you think you did a good enough job at Oregon State? I forget wins and losses.
Yeah, I should have stayed longer at Oregon State. But again, you got to understand you remember the Pac-10 at the time was ridiculous.
It was ridiculous.
Every team in that league was an NCAA tournament team except for us and Washington State. So
well, look, but let me say what you can't say. Okay, Cal was cheating at the time. They got caught cheating. So it's not like, oh, Gottlieb's breaking news. Like, no, they were buying dudes, and they had dudes, right? Yeah. Tony Gonzalez didn't have to buy because he's football. Jermaine Folks, Jelani Gardner, like, they had dudes.
Dudes.
Sharif, dudes, okay? Stanford had Mike Montgomery, who's unbelievable, yeah. Right? And they had pros everywhere. Adam Keith, Collins Twin, Lichty, like, you kind of go through it. Artie Lee, like, they had Revan Knight, dudes. UW had just now finally gotten it going.
Yeah.
Oregon started to get it going with Jerry Green.
Yeah.
UCLA has got like 7 or 8 pros on their roster. Arizona wins the national championship during this period of time. They have all NBA players, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. Just dudes.
Yeah.
And then you're like Oregon State. You know, and you get did you sign Corey Benjamin? Was that your biggest signing?
Nah, I didn't sign Corey. He was after me. I was only there 2 years again, and I would have stayed at Oregon State. I think we would have done better. I'm not the same coach now I was then. Had a lot to learn, but right. You know, my dad passed away when I was there. He passed away in 2000. And the New Mexico job opens in my second year there. Well, my dad played at New Mexico.
Yep.
It was always my dream job.
Oh, just like signs. It was just like signs. Signs pointing you there, right? Dad dies. It's New Mexico. All the timing, everything aligned. It's like the good Lord giving you a sign. This is where you're supposed to be. Yeah.
And literally, I thought when I took the job, I thought, well, that'll be my last job. I'm at the place where I've always aspired to be, dream job, all of that. And, you know, in our first, Fran Priscilla was a coach that I preceded, and our first 3 years were first 2 years were a little tough. And then we, you know, Danny Granger was there my second year, and our third year, I mean, he was outstanding. Like, he was,
he's incredible.
Yeah, 16th pick in the draft. Well, we made it to the tournament in 3 years, lost to Villanova in the first round. But I really felt like, and I got a contract extension, I really felt like, man, I'm never going to leave this place. It's Albuquerque. The fan support was great, all that. And then Rudy Davalos, my AD, he retired. And he said, you know, I'm not so sure you will be long for this job when I leave. And I, why did he say that, Rudy? And he said, I just, anyway, we got a new AD, and I could tell, like, I wasn't his guy. We weren't winning.
So why? What was it about you that all of a sudden, you know, he comes in and says, hey, and you're like, man, contract extension, I'm good. And he says, yeah, I don't know. What was it?
Well, you know how volatile the fan base can be there. And we had lost some.
That is the only thing in the state that matters is New Mexico basketball.
No doubt. We had lost a few in a row on the road. Like, my fourth year, we were 17-13. And then my fifth and last year, I think we started out like 8-2. We had beaten the eighth ranked Wichita team and then lost to Bobby Huggins' Kansas State team in the final of a tournament in Vegas. And then we went on the road and lost to Bobby Knight for his whatever record-breaking win, and then lost our season opener to TCU. And I got back and we were like, I want to say 1-1 in neutral games and 0-4 on the road. And Paul Krebs, our AD, just, we had a meeting. He said, I'm really concerned about the road losses. I got jammed up. I got offended. I thought, man, I'm doing a great job, or we're doing a great job, and we should, you know, cut us a little slack. We, you know, we're still in the building mode. And I coached out of fear the latter part of the season. And about a month later, he decided to let me go and let me finish the season. I wasn't going to do that, but I called Dick Bennett, who's a mentor, and he said, don't quit on those kids. Make sure they know you're with them. And we lost like our last five, and it just ended poorly. The fan base there was
when you said you coached out of fear, and I understand what you're saying. Like, it's one of the things that, you know, like, I think kind of the old school coaches don't know that they don't mean to do it to every kid, but there's occasionally kids who react that way. Like, I feel like that was my biggest issue in playing for Coach Sutton. We all kind of feared him, but I would play in an effort to try and please him, right? Yeah. So I wouldn't shoot, because if I'd shoot and miss, he'd get mad. Right? And it was just I was scared of him taking me out of the game, whereas guys on my team were like, yo, we can't win without you. Just, you know, do what you do and let him figure it out. Well, that sounds great, but when you're a pleaser as a kid and you're a coach's son who's been, you know, called time and again, like, you do what your coach says. You know, you got to play your game within reason. But as a coach, I never heard a coach say you coach out of fear. How did it affect you to coach out of fear?
Yeah, it just, again, now, this is my dream job. This is where my dad played. My whole desire, one of my greatest desires, was to, you know, to make the McKay name, make my dad proud, and make people proud of our time in as Lobos. And
right.
So the opinion of others was way too important to me, and I feared letting them down. And I think when we as men live in that or drive in that lane, we're very susceptible to, you know, to ruin. So it is. And again, it wasn't a time in my life that I felt really healthy emotionally or spiritually. And don't get me wrong, God was faithful. He knew I needed to go through that. Part of that process was, you know, coming to the end of myself and relying more on my faith than I did just on me. So, yeah, and that was it. That was the year five. I was done, and I was without work for about 3 weeks. Thought about going into being a color analyst for TV, and interviewed at the Mountain Network, the now defunct Mountain Network, and then Liberty called, and I went out to the East Coast for the first time and became the head coach at Liberty.
Okay, but you left in the middle, right, to work for Tony Bennett.
So I'm at Liberty for 2 years. Well, we have Seth Curry, Steph's brother. He was a nation's leading scorer. We had beaten Virginia my second year. And, man, I was enjoying it. I really loved being there. The school was great. People were great. But Tony called and said, you know, I want you to come and be my associate head coach. He offered me a ridiculous contract. And I first said no. Felt good about being a head coach. Kind of like it. And then, you know, my wife and I, we prayed about it. And he asked again. And, man, I just felt like it was – I felt like I needed to go and serve instead of be served. And being an assistant, I hadn't been an assistant for 13 years at the time, but I thought it would be healthy for me just to, you know, Dick Bennett, again, my mentor, Tony and I were good friends. I felt like I owed Coach Bennett something, Coach Dick Bennett, because of how good he had been to me. And I decided to go. And I didn't know what I was signing up for, Doug. You know, when you go from making all those decisions, when you practice, who you recruit, whether or not you can go see your kids play, and you're an assistant, you're now supporting a vision, not casting it. It was different, but man, was it really good for me. Not only did I get some mind space back, not being indicted by the loss, you know, coaching in freedom, really investing in relationships and being that same transformational type coach that I alluded to that I had, it helped me recalibrate and recenter what my purpose was in coaching. And then I learned from the best, a defensive system that, you know, we've implemented here that's proven to be pretty efficient.
How does Tony do it? How do you, in this climate, that, and if you have to run, you just tell me.
Yeah, you're good.
In this climate where basketball is just not taught to most AAU kids, high-level kids, the way it's played at Virginia, okay? And I remember when Tony got the job, and we could go back and, you know, because it was a search firm hire and he had no ties to the area, it'll never work, right? You got to recruit the DMV. You got to get local kids. You can't play slow. How does he do it?
So I think Tone wanted the job because he thought it could be like a Stanford on the East Coast. And he admired the fit that you know, Stanford kids had, because they had a conscientiousness in the classroom, and that sometimes translates on the court as well. And our first recruiting class, I'm not talking about when we first got there in April, but the class after that, man, they were called the six shooters. it was six guys. It was ranked fifth in the country or something. And it was six players, of which only two of them stayed. And so our first 2 years were 15 and 16 and then 16 and 15. So we're 31 and 31 after two. And man, the three things that I think would answer your question. Number one, he's amazingly consistent. He's got an unwavering belief in the way you play defensively and the commitment that you have to have to it. Number two, he recruits the right kind of guys. Like he was uninterested in what the ranking was. I know you were a highly rated recruit, but you had to have a sense of selflessness and a really competitive and passionate disposition for the game in order to be successful for him. And man, I'm telling you, like Joe Harris and London Perrantes and Anthony Gill, and like, we just took Akil Mitchell. We took guys, like we were beating mid-majors on guys. And I think then thirdly, what's not talked about, you know, cause not many people, he's such a humble individual. He's really one of the best coaches I've been around, but one of the best people. He's got this.
But how is that? That's real. Okay. I mean, is that, I'll never forget when Virginia lost to UMBC the year before when they lost to Syracuse, had the thing won, going to the Final Four, right? Yeah. And they grabbed Tony after the game. And I mean, I have no ties to the program. Zero. Other than I've known Tony most of my life, and I respect and admire him, and he's been incredible to me as his dad. But this calm kind of grace, compassion, that's a real thing. That's not just a TV thing.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. He's you know, his dad would tell you how temperamental he was, and that's why he retired. Like he just the little things bothered his dad. And Tone has this ability, his faith is, he's deeply rooted, but he's got this ability that I'm just telling you, that third quality, he's insatiable about getting better. So, but he's got this ability to process the negative in such a way that it motivates him or inspires him to turn it to the good, to turn it to improvement, to use it as a lesson and not a loss. It's uncanny. It's like, and not many people have the depth that he has in his, not only in his faith, but in his person. And I think because of that, man, you know, he probably doesn't have an enemy in the world, but I think he has success because he's relentless in pursuing the desired outcome and unwavered by adversity.
What was your decision like to leave?
It wasn't hard because it was back to Liberty, a place that I really had an affinity for. Yet I knew I was going to miss the significance of the game. You know, when you're like, when I left, we were number two in the country for, I don't know, 10 weeks of the year. And every game was a big game. It was sold out every venue we played in, and just being able to compete for it all was, I really, really liked it. I wanted to be a head coach again, and I couldn't imagine a better place to get a chance to do it at the time than Liberty. So that didn't make it hard, but, and it was an hour from Tone and Laurel. So, you know, we're close, we're friends. It felt right. But I do miss the, you know, the significance of the game on occasions, yet, you know, they've reached such a high level now. Whenever they lose, it's, the sky is falling. He's created an expectation there that's hard to keep up with.
What does it mean to you? What does it signify to people who have been around that program and Tony and how you guys built it to see him win the whole thing?
Oh, it was phenomenal. You know, especially given what you alluded to earlier, when he was interviewed outside the locker room after the first one seed had ever lost to a 16, and he did the interview number one. Most people wouldn't have done it. But the words that he said, I just thought it was special. I thought that meant more to most coaches and to a lot of people than you winning a national championship and saying whatever you said after that game. So I think it was God's way of saying, hey, here's a gift to you for being obedient to what you were called to. And I couldn't have been happier. Couldn't have thought of someone that deserved it more.
But to have left and watched them win it.
Oh.
What are those emotions like?
Tough. Yeah. You know, I still don't have a national championship ring, but no, I was happy for those guys, man. They labored hard in order to do something like that. And I had been gone a few years. So Jack Salt, Ty Jerome, Kyle Guy, some of those guys were still guys that I recruited or helped recruit. But it's hard to watch someone else win a national championship. But, you know, I felt like I was a little part of it. And it gave me a dream that one day we were going to cut the nets ourselves.
Okay, so you get back to Liberty. Now you've done a little bit of everything, right? You've been a head coach starting a program. You've been a head coach at Colorado State. You've been back to Oregon State. That didn't work out well. New Mexico was your dream job. You lose that job. You go to Liberty. You go back to being an assistant. Now you're back at Liberty. How are you now different than you ever used to be?
Very intentional about the whole person. And making sure that I'm faithful to the privilege of being the privilege of shepherding or stewarding someone else. I've heard it said, you're a parent, we don't own our kids. We're just supposed to be great stewards of them. And man, I just think that's my daily pursuit, to make sure that our guys and their experience is something that they will remember and be able to recall in a life-shaping way that is lasting and that is significant. So I think when you have that approach, you're not as indicted about the outcome. You can really invest in the process, and you don't get so hung up with a result, and whether it's win or lose. So I think that's how I'm different, just in that place of emotionally and spiritually healthy that I again referenced earlier. I think I'm in a way better place, obviously, 20 years later.
You are, you already had your dream job, right? But now you got Mr. Falwell and that school have given you two opportunities. What is it like now to be kind of back in the tournament? You know, a guy who now has kind of reestablished their value in terms of, you know, could you get a different job? Understanding that Liberty's twice giving you opportunity. Like, what's that balance like?
I don't think about it much, Doug, just because I've moved so much now. We're empty nesters, and you know, I think it's different now, but man, I love where I am. And I think we've got a really healthy culture, and we've gotten to a place now where we've beaten some high majors. We're kind of on the mid-major map, and you know how hard it is to schedule when you arrive at that place.
Yeah.
So I think for me, I read this in a book by Mark Batterson called Win the Day. He said, we have to have this ability to bury, B-U-R-Y, dead yesterdays and not worry about unborn tomorrows. And I think when we do that, we can make the most of our 24. And that's what I'm trying to do, and be present, not only in their lives, but where I am in my own old age, and enjoy this process, man, because it's fun.
What would it mean to beat Oklahoma State? You know, Mike's a great dude. He's done an amazing job there. They probably have the number one draft pick in the upcoming draft. What would that mean for you personally, for your program, for the university?
Well, we beat Mississippi State a couple of years ago, and it was the first tournament win in our school's history. That was great. We then lost the next Sunday to Buzz Williams' Virginia Tech team. So, and then last year we qualified but didn't have the tournament. So I don't think our guys will be overwhelmed by the moment. I know you'll be rooting hard for your Cowboys. I appreciate that. And I really, really like Mike. He's a tremendous dude. I'm waiting for you to ask the questions about the game plan so you can text it to him. But obviously, when you have a player like Cunningham, like that dude, he's special. Well, if he's not one, he'll be two, and he'll play for 15 years if he stays healthy. But they also have some other really good players, and they're the 11th ranked team in the country. They shouldn't have been a four seed. It would mean a lot. Yet, you know, I do think our guys haven't won a few high major games over the years. I don't think they'll be afraid of the moment, but we'll have to do a great job in order just to compete with them. They're really good.
Richie, I'm so happy you found peace, happiness, and success, right? And those things, success doesn't always mean winning games, but it doesn't hurt when you do win games. And I'm just fortunate to know you and appreciative of your time. I wish you the best of luck against my
mom. Yeah, thank you, man. I feel the same about you. You've got a great platform, and you use it wisely, man. Thanks for all you do to better people's lives. And if we do, or if we're fortunate enough to upset the Cowboys, man, I'm going to send you some Liberty gear so you can fly the colors.
Hey, I'll take some Liberty gear anyway. I got a little dude. I got an 11-year-old lefty. He may not be a high major. I may be calling you about recruiting down the road.
All right, I'm taking all lefties, man. They can shoot that thing.
You can shoot that thing. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Richie.
Thanks, Doug.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that. It was good. It's interesting. He's a very nice man and very interesting perspective and some really thoughtful commentary on how he's grown as a person and how he helps young men mature as people. And then the consistency of Tony Bennett. That one really jumped out at me, right? He's just consistent, everyday guy. You can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. There's consistency for you on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app. We got more pods coming. You go back and you listen to some of the old ones. Justin Bean at Utah State, Ryan Odom, of course, UMBC. We have tons of them. You go back, Steve Prohm, join me. I know he just lost his job. There's some really, really good ones. Anyway, I'm Doug Gottlieb. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Ball.